I want to personally invite you to join me and all the other Brock stars for this year's 13th live and in-person Plan Stock event outside of Asheville, North Carolina, in the little town of Black Mountain. It's 1,500 acres, is loaded with wildlife, trees, trails, streams. It is a nature wonderland. And what's also a wonderland are all the incredible speakers that you get to hang with all weekend long, like Jane and Ann Esselstyn, Dr. Will Bolshewitz of Fiberfueled, Carly Bodrug, Miss Plant U, Dr. Gemma Newman is over from the UK. We have Dr. Dawn Musalem from the Mayo Clinic, John Mackey, the ex-CEO of Whole Food Market Stores, myself, Brian Hart, and a special appearance by the Plant Bros. Here's the kicker. All these Brock stars are there from Friday till Sunday, and they want to rub elbows with all of you, whether it's over buffets of Plant Strong fare for breakfast, lunch, and dinner, whether it's going on an afternoon hike, a swim, pickleball, frisbee golf, kickball, cornhole, dancing. We're having live music. It's all there in this fun weekend extravaganza that we affectionately call Plant Stock. Simply go to liveplantstrong.com and then click on Plant Stock 2024 and grab yourself a ticket before they sell out. See you there. If there's one request that we've gotten more than any other at Plant Strong Foods, it's been to make products that are certified gluten-free. Well, my cruciferous cousins, today is your lucky day. Our three just launched all-new pancake and waffle mixes are here, and I am thrilled to announce that one of them is not only gluten-free, but it still holds up to our best-in-class nutritional standards. It's made with whole oat, buckwheat, sorghum, and cassava flours with a whisper, a slight kiss of dates for sweetness. This light, fluffy, deliciously bready mix is great for people of all ages and dietary preferences. You're going to be getting 19 grams of whole grains, and it's never been easier or more delicious. Just visit plantstrongfoods.com and check out the home-style gluten-free pancake and waffle mix. I'm Rip Esselstyn, and welcome to the Plant Strong Podcast. The mission at Plant Strong is to further the advancement of all things within the plant-based movement. We advocate for the scientifically proven benefits of plant-based living and envision a world that universally understands, promotes, and prescribes plants as a solution to empowering your health, enhancing your performance, restoring the environment, and becoming better guardians to the animals we share this planet with. We welcome you wherever you are on your Plant Strong journey, and I hope that you enjoy the show. Several months ago, I came across a book with a title that I just couldn't ignore. It's called Fast Food Ingredients Revealed, What Are You Eating? I think we all know that fast food is, for the most part, crap, right? It's just calorie-rich and processed crap. But what I didn't realize is just how bad some of it really is. I mean, we're talking preservatives, coloring agents, additives, and sweeteners made with actual, catch this, actual chemical warfare agents. Just to name a few of the things that should scare all of us right out of the drive-through line. Not surprisingly, the food industry doesn't want us to know what's really in that box of fried chicken or that juicy burger because it goes well beyond inhumanely raised animals. But luckily, author Mel Weinstein does know what's in this food because he's spent decades studying it as a food chemist. Mel worked as an analytical chemist for over 20 years in a research center for a multinational food ingredients company, and he studied food science at the graduate level as well. He also taught chemistry at the community college level for 10 years, so it has been a true passion of his for decades to study industrial foods and explore the purpose of additives and their impact on health. it's no surprise that the long-term impacts are not good. So it's his hope to educate people on what's really inside that taco shell besides the beans and a few sprinkles of lettuce. Enjoy this eye-opening dive into food ingredients with Mel Weinstein. Hey, Mel Weinstein, how you doing?
I'm doing great. It's good to be on your show, Rip.
Hey, yeah, it's great to have you on it.
Yeah, thanks for inviting me. I've listened to it for several years, and I enjoy the diversity of your podcast, of Plant Strong Podcast, all the different people you have on and the different things that they share, you know, lots of different topics. So I really appreciate that.
Yeah, well, thank you very much. And I'm really excited to dive into what is your expertise, which I'm not going to say quite yet.
Oh, okay.
Because before we talk about, you know, I think what you have really drilled into in a really phenomenal way is I'd like to know a little bit more about Mel. So Tell me, where am I talking to you from?
I am in central Illinois right now, in the city of Decatur.
All right. Have you been there long?
I actually have, a lot longer than I ever thought I would be. Yeah, I moved here in 1980.
1980, okay. Well, that's about as long as I've been in Austin, Texas.
Okay.
Yeah. I came here to go to school in 82. So, I mean, 80. So you've been there, what, 43 years? Is that right?
Yeah. Putting it like that sounds like a lifetime.
Yeah. And why did you go there in 1980?
Well, it was for a job. And I had gotten interested in education. And I started to search around for a place I could teach. I had a master's degree in chemistry. I made me eligible to teach in, you know, smaller schools like community colleges. And so an opportunity came along to take a job at a community college in Decatur where they were adding chemistry as a new curriculum. And so I got hired to create the chemistry department and set up the curriculum and facilities and all of that.
Nice. So was that the chemistry for the consumer course?
Actually, that came earlier. Yeah, after I graduated from college, I was kind of bumming around, you know, looking for something that I would enjoy doing for work. And I wound up getting a job at another community college, which was in Dayton, Ohio. And they gave me an opportunity to start teaching part-time. And after I started doing that, I came across this book called Chemistry for the Consumer. And I thought, well, you know, a lot of people have to take science classes, and these science classes might scare the heck out of them, you know. And chemistry had, you know, one of those reputations, you know, along with physics, in terms of intimidating people who were not geared towards science or mathematics. So I thought, well, it'd be really wonderful, you know, to be able to teach chemistry, you know, not only get the basic concepts across, but teach the practical aspects of it. Yeah. So when I came across this book called Chemistry for the Consumer, I thought, well, you know, why not use that book as a basis of a course for non-science majors? You know, people like nursing, people going into nursing and other areas where science was going to be a peripheral part of their education. And so maybe that wouldn't be as intimidating, maybe it would be more enjoyable, and they could learn some useful things, you know, like chemistry having to do with food, having to do with cooking, household, you know, products and things like that.
What was it about chemistry that fascinated you?
Well, that's an interesting question, because when I got to college, I was one of those people who had no idea what I wanted to study, what would be the kind of career I would get into. And so it took me a year to kind of land on chemistry. Basically by eliminating everything I knew I didn't want to do.
Yeah.
And so what was left was like science and math. And I looked at my grades in high school, and I thought, well, I did pretty good in that. So that's how I arrived at chemistry. It wasn't any kind of burning desire I'd had, you know, since I was 5 years old.
Right. And you started your eating as a vegetarian in 1995. Is that correct?
Around then. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. And what pushed you in that direction back then?
Well, it wasn't the first time I had got introduced to vegetarianism. I got exposed to it in the mid 1970s, rather by accident, because I wound up getting a job at a small university that had a spiritual basis to their teaching, and they were, again, like this, like the community college, they were starting up a chemistry program. And so I was involved with that organization back then, and an opening came up and I got invited to go out there and help set up their chemistry classes. And everybody who attended and who worked at that university ate vegetarian. Room and board was provided, and if you wanted to eat on campus, you ate vegetarian.
Was it Seventh-day Adventist?
No, it wasn't. It was associated with the Transcendental Meditation organization.
Yeah.
And they had purchased a campus in Iowa. It used to be Parsons College or something like that. And they renamed it and refitted it and hired a lot of people to teach there.
Right. And so your journey from vegetarian to vegan happened when and why?
Well, there was a long gap. Okay. So I worked for that organization for about a year and a half. Like I said, I knew nothing about vegetarianism before I went there. I never had met a vegetarian before. It was all new to me. And sometimes I would find myself escaping from campus and going to a fast food restaurant in town. So it took some getting used to. But then when I cut ties with that organization, like it's about a year and a half later, I slowly lost, you know, my newly acquired interest in vegetarianism, because I had no friends, no relatives. And of course, back in the 70s, there wasn't a whole lot of support, you know, in terms of eating that way. So it took another, you know, roughly 19, 20 years before I came back to it. And that was because I met my wife, who was a vegetarian. And it's not like I had lost all interest in it, but I had gone back to eating meat and a little bit of dairy products, as much as I could tolerate. And she gave me this book one day. Of course, everybody probably who listens to this podcast knows about this book, Diet for a Small Planet.
Oh.
And read through that book. And by the end, I said to her, well, I think I'm ready to, now I've got the knowledge and the understanding, I'm ready to switch over.
Yeah, that was Francis Moore LePay. Wrote that, actually, I think it was in the 70s.
Oh, wait a second. I gave you the wrong title. Diet for a New America.
Oh, yeah. No, that was John Robbins.
That was John Robbins. Yes. I read both of them, actually, but it was the Robbins book. It was the first one.
Got it. Oh, yeah. Yeah, that one. Yeah, that one has sold over like 2 million copies. John has done remarkably well with that and influenced so many people. Okay. So you mentioned in there fast food and how you used to be a self-proclaimed fast food addict. Is that correct?
I would say junk food addict.
Okay. You know,
fast food was part of that, of course. Yeah. But, you know, back when I was growing up, there were very few fast food restaurants, particularly where I was living. And so, you know, I just got into junk food. It's sort of surprising when I look back to those days how little restrictions were placed upon me as far as, you know, eating candy, cakes, you know, things with sugar in them, very sweet things. And I don't remember, you know, getting lectures from my parents. I don't recall anything in my education that warned me about eating those kinds of foods. And actually, it wasn't until I was in my mid-20s when I came across a book called Sugar Blues, which you may have heard of. It's one of the first books to really come down on sugar in the diet. And so I read that and I thought, whoa, you know, maybe I shouldn't be eating this way. So, you know, I didn't have a very good beginnings as far as diet was concerned. Yeah, you name the junk food, the, you know, the candy bars, the cakes, you know, all the different kinds of baked goods, the sodas, the sweetened drinks, you know, all of that. I was pretty much liked most of it.
Yeah. Well, most of America does.
Yeah. And so it took a long time. I mean, I was in my 30s, even if I read Sugar Blues, it took me a long time to really start, you know, cutting down and paying attention to what I was eating.
Yeah. Well, I think this is an appropriate time for me to just mention. So what I'd love to talk to you about today, Mel,
sure,
and dive into is this book that you wrote called Fast Food Ingredients Revealed. What are you eating? And it's kind of, you know, in reading through this, Mel, it's really, I am just stunned and amazed at the breadth of your knowledge on this subject area and how much wonderful research and effort you've put into this book. So congrats on that.
Thank you. Yeah, it's pretty dense. It's got a lot of information in it.
Oh yeah, it's dense and it's also very intense, and that's good. So in the book, you mentioned there's like two types of corn. I think the manufacturers use field corn and sweet corn. What's the difference between the two?
And what you see growing in the fields around where I live and many other Midwestern states is what is known as field corn. It's also called dent corn, D-E-N-T. And it's not what we buy in the grocery stores as the corn on the cob. That's sweet corn. So very little, very few of the farms in Illinois are going to be growing sweet corn. Okay. That only has one purpose, you know, that's to eat it. It's a whole food. It's wonderful. But it's not what the American economy runs on.
Is the field corn grown for like livestock?
Partly. There's hundreds of products that can be derived from that corn. So essentially it gets, it gets harvested, all the kernels get knocked off of it. It gets shipped to silos where it's stored and eventually winds up at the company I worked at, Tate & Lyle and Grain Elevators. And that corn gets broken down into its component parts. And those parts are, I'm sure, you know, most people are familiar with them. It gets broken down into starch or corn starch, gets broken down into oil. And then there is a proteinaceous or protein and fiber portions of that, that comes from the corn kernels. The corn starch can get broken down and turned into many, many different things. And then, of course, the oil, you know, gets sold as vegetable oil. And what is left over, the cheap stuff, is what becomes animal feed, ultimately. Mm. And that comes in two forms, corn gluten meal and corn gluten feed. So after the really valuable parts of the corn are removed and processed into other things, then the remainder is what gets sold livestock.
So you use the word gluten in there. So does corn have gluten in it? I thought gluten was kind of a wheat kind of ingredient.
Yeah, it's a different kind of gluten, but yeah, it's found in both crops. Okay. Most people are, you know, have allergies to wheat gluten.
Right. All right. I want to take a little departure from corn. I want to ask you about, so like in 1977, there was something pretty important that happened, and that was with George McGovern. And right. they were trying to figure out, what was it, some Senate meetings, conferences about what to do to make the American diet healthier. Is that correct?
Right, right. Yeah, George McGovern was instrumental in promoting an investigation into the food system in the United States. He got wind of the fact that even though, you know, America is one of the richest countries in the world, hunger, you know, was still a problem. In addition to hunger, also he realized that there wasn't good information about nutrition. So even if you're not hungry and you have all the food you can eat, you can still be get sick, right? Be in a bad way. So he put together a Senate subcommittee to investigate the conditions in the United States. And that was called the, I'm looking up here to get it right, U.S. Senate Select Committee on Nutrition and Human Needs. And so this occurred around 1970, and it took a long time. And this committee met over and over again. They had lots of meetings and discussions, and it took about 7 years for them to publish their results. And this is around 1977. And they put out what is called the Dietary Goals for the United States. Dietary Goals for the United
States. And these goals were kind of headed in the right direction, right?
Yeah, they are what spurred a few years later the Dietary Guidelines for Americans, which put out very formal recommendations on what Americans should be eating to maintain good nutrition. And that got established so that every 5 years, they reexamined the goals and put out a new book, essentially, on what Americans should be eating.
Yeah, but those dietary goals, like back in like 1977, if I'm not mistaken, it recommended like a 20% increase in the consumption of complex carbohydrates, like bravo there. And naturally occurring, sugars and fruits, a 45% reduction in refined sugars and a 40% reduction in fat consumption. But somehow or another, my understanding is the food companies, they took that and they ran with it, and they somehow like outfoxed us with all these fat-free products that were loaded with crap.
Yeah. Essentially, I mean, they were way ahead of their time as far as what they recommended. And if everything they'd recommended got adopted, we'd be one healthier population today. But you're right about the food manufacturing companies. They did not like those recommendations, you know, because it would cut in, you know, to their bottom line and into their profits. So they fought hard to dilute those recommendations or eliminate those recommendations and make the less healthy foods more the center of the plate than what McGovern's committee was recommending.
Yeah. I mean, you talk about an ingredient that I think came out of that, which was the Olean or Olestra, right? It is a undigestible type of fat, and it basically goes right through you, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, that's an interesting piece of food history there. This was in the 1990s, and the government health agencies were coming down on fat. Okay, fat was the boogeyman during that time, and so they recommended that the food manufacturers start cutting back significantly on the amount of fat in their products. So, you know, the food manufacturers, you know, responded because, you know, what was their choice? You know, if the government was telling the population, you know, stop eating foods high in fat, then the food manufacturers would, lose a lot of money again. So the race was on to create substitutes for fat. Not just remove fat from processed foods, because, you know, that could ruin the taste, mouthfeel, texture, and all of that of the foods. Fat plays a significant role in that respect. But if they could come up with other products that would provide all of the properties of fat, or most of the properties, then that would be a suitable solution. So you mentioned Olean or Olestra, and that was Procter and Gamble originated that ingredient. And surprisingly, it was made from sugar. I'm certainly not going to go into details of that, but there's all kinds of things you can do with chemistry to convert one food product into another and radically change it. So the smart food chemists and food scientists determined that you could modify sugar to create a fat-like substance. And not only was it fat-like and could replace, you know, the typical fats and oils in foods, but it was indigestible. It was non-caloric. I mean, it sounded like a miracle, you know, at the time. And not only could you eat it and not gain any weight, but you could use it to fry foods, you know, so you could heat it up to high enough temperatures, you could make French fries in it. Yeah. And they thought they had a tremendous blockbuster of an ingredient here. But when they started making products with it and putting it out into the marketplace, they found something that they didn't expect to happen. I guess they didn't do their thorough research. But as people started eating more and more products with this Olestra in it, or I should say Olean, because you think about that word, that's a very smart moniker to have on a product, Olean,
right?
Skinny, right? People were getting severe indigestion, you know, and all the things associated with severe indigestion, which I don't need to go into.
Well, and but so, I know you don't want to go into it, but I'm going to say it because there was a warning, I think, on the label of some of these foods that said, warning, may cause anal leakage. I mean,
oh, yeah. Severe, that was one of the severe symptoms. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
So as the governmental agencies started getting reports back from consumers, you know, like USDA, the FDA, that these products were making them sick, then the government had to act. They did not tell the food companies to stop, you know, manufacturing these foods, you know, because they had been approved by the FDA. But the food manufacturers realized that with all this bad publicity, it was going downhill. One of the companies that used Olean was Frito-Lay.
Yeah.
And they made these chips. I don't know if people in your audience are old enough to remember Wow chips, W-O-W with an exclamation point. Yeah. And they were like the perfect snack, you know, because you weren't, you know, getting the calories from fat. You could lose weight eating these things. But then eventually people started making fun of them, you know, like, wow, these chips are making me sick.
Yeah. Yeah.
So they stopped producing those eventually.
Oh, I'm sure they did. Now, let's get into fast food, which is probably where you feel super comfortable. Is that accurate?
Well, that's what the book's mainly about.
Exactly. And you talk about how most consumers really have no clue what they're eating. Exactly. They know what the menu items are, but in the basic components, for example, like lettuce, you know, bacon, mayonnaise in a BLT, but they have absolutely no idea what's in the food, and that was really the purpose of your book.
And do you know why we don't know much about the ingredients in fast foods?
No, you have to tell me.
Okay, I sure will. Well, you know, back in the, let me get my year right. It was 1966. There was the Fair Packaging and Labeling Act. Okay. And it's one of those gifts from our government, where that for the first time food manufacturers were required to list the ingredients on their packaging. Okay. And that, when you think about it, that wasn't that long ago, you know,
not
from 66 to now. Prior to that, you know, it was voluntary. You know, food companies could share the information about what was in their foods or not. But now there was this requirement, you know, where you didn't have a choice anymore. You had to list the ingredients, and they got listed from the one that was present in the largest amount by weight all the way to the last one, which was the lowest amount by weight. Well, that was a lot of information provided to the American consumer if they wanted to take advantage of it. Now, years later, this is 1990, there was the Nutrition Labeling and Education Act, which is another small gift to Americans, where in order for a food company to make any kind of claim, like a health claim, like, you know, low fat or good for your heart or, you know, prevents cancer, whatever, they had to justify that claim. They couldn't just make it and put it on their wrappers or cans or whatever. And then the one that I am interested the most about is the law called 1999. Actually, it doesn't have its own name. It's part of the earlier law. But that was the first time nutrition facts labels appeared on food products. So that was 1994. Again, not that long ago, maybe 30 years ago.
Yeah.
And here, you know, the government says, not only do you get to know what's in your food, if it's a packaged food, but you also get to know all this nutritional information about it. And the nutrition facts label is packed for anybody who wants to really delve into it. There's just loads and loads and loads of information that might benefit you in terms of what you eat and how good it is for you. And it was standardized. You know, the food companies didn't have any choice. They had this format they had to follow. So, you know, every single can, packaged food, frozen food that you pick up, you'll see the layout of the nutrition facts label to be exactly the same. So once you learn how to use one label, you know how to use them all, get information from them. But let's go back to what I mentioned about the requirement of food companies to reveal what ingredients are in their products. That did not apply to restaurants, period. So we Americans are very trusting, you know, when it comes to the food we eat. And we like to think that, okay, if we're cooking at home, we pretty much know exactly what's going into our foods. We have some confidence about the ingredients. If we buy packaged foods, yeah, we got information there. But if we go out to a restaurant or we go to somebody else's house to eat dinner or lunch, or we go to a cookout or a picnic, we're very trusting. We don't ask questions about what's in those foods that we're eating.
Yeah.
And the restaurants, with no requirement to tell us what the ingredients are in their foods, they have a choice. They can do it or they cannot do it. So, you know, I have this podcast called Food Labels Revealed that I started in 2016. And over the years, I was doing mainly, you know, mainly shows about what was in the manufactured foods that showed up in grocery stores, big box stores, convenience stores. But then I started thinking, well, what does show up in fast food? And I started poking around on the internet saying, okay, can I get that information? Is it published somewhere? And what I found out, there was a small select group of restaurants, fast food restaurants, mm-hmm. that did publish that information at their websites. And we're talking maybe a dozen restaurants here out of the hundreds, you know, of restaurants out in the world. So started looking more closely. Okay, what did they reveal? Did they give all the menu items? Did they tell us all the ingredients in each of these menu items? And so I did find there was a considerable amount of information out there. So certain restaurants, I'll name the three that I talk about in my book, McDonald's, Pizza Hut, and Taco Bell. There were others, as I said, there's maybe a dozen or so, but I chose those three to write about. because they're kind of representative, you know, McDonald's, all American food, you know, Pizza Hut, obviously, you know, Italian cuisine sort of, and then, you know, had Taco Bell, got the Mexican food.
Yeah. So, right. Make a run for the border.
Yeah. I thought, you know, that kind of run the gamut pretty well. It didn't cover everything, but I thought, you know, if I look at these three, maybe they're representative of most fast food restaurants. And the other question I wanted to answer with the research was, do they use the same fast food ingredients as the foods you find in the grocery stores? Mm. Yeah. So I, for, oh gosh, like a year or so, I just mined these websites, you know, wrote down every single menu item for each of those three restaurants. I wrote all the ingredients for each menu item. And then I began to.
So those Mel, so those three restaurants, McDonald's, Taco Bell, and Pizza Hut, they all were transparent as far as you can go online and see what the ingredients were?
Some more than others. McDonald's, I think, was the most upfront about it. The other restaurants, you know, I would say probably 90% plus of what they had on their menus. The problem I ran into is that they have regional menus and they have national menus. So I wouldn't always find the ingredients that were in the regional foods.
Yeah. Okay. Sorry to interrupt.
Sure. So anyway, I did a lot of collating and categorizing of these ingredients. And basically, I decided that I want to be able to come up with a way of describing a particular food item in these three fast food restaurants as being, you know, somewhat processed, very processed, extremely processed. I wanted to be able to put a number on it, you know, so if somebody was looking at it and they wanted to compare one menu item against another, they could say, well, if I'm interested in my health, you know, maybe I should put the, I should choose the less processed item over the one that was extremely processed. So without going into all the details, I do go into it in my book. I've got a whole section in the appendix on how I calculated what I call the processed food index.
And so, using that processed food index, so the PFI, and then you can assign a food, a number based on that?
Yeah, it ranged from 0 to 100. And, you know, of course, there is essentially nothing that you that calculate as zero. And there's nothing you can calculate as 100. So there's nothing perfectly so pure that it's not processed. And there's nothing so processed, you know.
So help me out here, Mel. If it was a one, was it like not processed at all, like an apple? And if it was 100, was it highly processed or 99?
Yeah, like I said, there was nothing that was 100. So let me give you the ranges. It started, of course, at 0, and we went, and then the next range was 1 to 10. And 1 to 10, I was calling lightly industrialized. I stopped using the word processed because process has such a diluted definition these days. It can be good, it could be in the middle, it could be bad. So I started using the word industrialized at this point. So 1 to 10 was lightly industrialized. Then 11 to 40 was moderately industrialized, and then 41 to 70 was highly industrialized, and then 71 to 100 was extremely industrialized.
Can you give me an example of a food that was extremely industrialized?
Yeah, I got several examples. Let's take.
I'm going to ask you a bunch of questions about different ingredients. So you don't have to rattle off some, but just give me one right now, just, you know, for kicks and grins.
Okay. Well, do you want me to start with the menu item or with the ingredient? Might be easier with the menu item.
Sure. Absolutely. That sounds good.
Yeah. So let's start with a Pizza Hut. I do have an example for each restaurant, if you're interested and have time for this. The restaurant menu item is crispy chicken Caesar salad. Crispy chicken seasoned salad.
Yeah.
Caesar salad. And at first, you know, if you're looking at the menu of the restaurant and you see the word salad, right? And you're thinking, whoa, that's probably a lot better for me than other items, you know, in the menu. Well, you could be very, very wrong about this. This salad has, in terms of calories, 830 calories. Okay. Mm-hmm. Now, oftentimes you hear that the average American should be eating around 2,000 calories a day.
Yep.
And so if you're eating a salad that's got 830 calories in it, you're 3/4 of the way to your daily requirement, you know. So this is not a salary you want to eat to lose weight.
Not quite a half. Not quite a half to your daily. So more like.
What did I say?
3/4. Yeah.
I'm sorry. Not quite a half. Yeah. Thanks for correcting me there.
And what percent of those 800 plus calories are coming from fat? Do you know? Do you have it up there?
No, I don't. What I have down here is that if you count all the ingredients in the salad, there's 114.
Wow. Incredible.
114. Yeah. Now, if you eliminate all the replicates, then you're looking at 73 unique ingredients. So just imagine, you know, somebody's at home and they'd say to themselves, hey, I'd like to make this crispy chicken Caesar salad. You know, they'd have to find 73 different ingredients to put this thing together. All right, so that's one of the astounding things, or several astounding things. How many ingredients wind up in fast foods? How many of those are unique? And then I calculated the PFI, Processed Food Index, and I got a number of 52.
52 for that chicken
52%. Caesar.
Yeah, 52% chicken Caesar salad, huh?
Yeah. So that put it in the highly industrialized category.
How is something that has 71 ingredients not a extremely industrialized PFI?
Well, you will find examples of foods that are made up of natural ingredients. So it's possible. That's a pretty high number to find that many. But, you know, I have come across products with 20, 30 ingredients on them that would have very low PFIs. Huh? You know, so they're not very industrialized.
Right. Like a Pop-Tart.
Like a Pop-Tart. No, Pop-Tart would not be a good example of that.
I know. I was quizzing you.
Yeah. But sometimes, you know, organic foods, you know, have very low PFI values.
Uh-huh. All right.
But anyway.
Yeah. Hit us with another example.
Okay. Let me give you one of the ingredients in that example, because you were asking about specific ingredients.
Yeah. I got a bunch I'm going to throw at you.
Yeah. Okay. Well, one of them is called, and only a chemist could love this name. It's called azodicarbonamide. See, I can't even say this. Yeah. I've been in chemistry for all these years. And so this is what you see on a label, you know, or you see at the website for Pizza Hut, you know, and just think about the average person in our society. Are they going to even be able to say that? Are they even going to know why that's there in this food product? No, you know, they're not going to have probably a clue. A very small percentage of our population would know what to do with that name, right? So where does this show up? Okay, where is it in the salad? It's in the croutons. And then if you dig a little deeper, you know, why is it there in the croutons? Well, every ingredient has a purpose and has a function, or it would not be in that menu item. Food companies are not going to waste money on ingredients that don't pay off in some way. Mm-hmm. And so it's in the crouton because what are croutons made of mostly?
Bread.
Bread, which is flour, right? So the flour that is used is, of course, the worst kind of flour that we should be eating. It's white flour. It's not a whole food. It doesn't come from whole wheat flour. It's flour that has been manipulated, treated to be made very white. And a little bit of history behind that is back in the 1800s, the only people that could afford to eat bread products made from white flour were the affluent, rich people. And the poor people, they were left with the whole wheat flour, which they did not like. It didn't last as long. It went bad on them. And so it's the refined flour that people wanted to buy. And so eventually technology caught up with the bread industry, and using the right machines and the right processing techniques, it became cheap to make white flour. So once it became cheap, the masses started to buy it. And eventually the whole wheat flours, people lost interest in them.
That sounds very similar to, you know, in China with the brown rice and the white rice.
Yeah, exactly.
Same phenomenon. Yeah.
Yeah. Good analogy. And so where does this additive come in? Well, this additive is a bleaching agent, literally a bleaching agent, and helps to make the white flour whiter, and therefore the white bread whiter and the croutons whiter or whatever.
Wow.
Another interesting note about it is that it has gotten a bad reputation in some places. I think it may be banned in Europe. Mm-hmm. And there are actually several fast food restaurants in the United States that have told the companies making the flour to stop using it. Or they weren't going to buy it.
And do you know why that is? Does it have some sort of deleterious effects on us?
Asthma. I think asthma is the primary thing.
Yeah. Well, that's we all like to breathe.
Yeah, that's important.
Yeah. Yeah. Nice smooth breath. So can I ask you some ingredients and what your thoughts are on them?
You can, if there are over 9,000 additives used in the food industry. So I'm not going to be on top of all of those. So you can go ahead and ask me. And I do have my book here I can refer to. It has a glossary in the back.
Yeah. And the reason why I've picked these is you mentioned them either when you're talking about McDonald's, Pizza Hut, or Taco Bell. So you actually highlight these ingredients that are in different meals at these restaurants, but also they're kind of familiar to me because they also appear in a lot of food products, packaged box and canned food products. So I think that it might be helpful for our listeners to hear your thoughts on some of these widely used additives. And if they get kind of the thumbs up or the thumbs down or a neutral from Mel Weinstein.
Okay. Well, that's putting a lot of authority on me.
I know. You can handle it. Natural flavors. What are your thoughts of natural flavors?
Okay. I have certain pet peeves when it comes to ingredients, and that's one of them. Natural flavors almost means nothing on a label. Very little information provided. So it's a thumbs down. And it's one of those freebies that the Food and Drug Administration gave to food manufacturers where they made exceptions. They said, well, if you're using natural flavors in your foods, you don't have to tell the consumers what they are. You can just simply use this generic term, either natural flavor or natural flavors, and not reveal what they are. So if somebody should happen to have a food allergy and a flavor is made from that particular food, they may not be alerted to it unless it was underneath the allergen disclosure, on the label.
So they're not really playing ball. It's kind of a little slippery ball that they're playing where they can disguise and slip in really whatever they want under the guise of natural flavors.
Yeah. Now there is one, there's natural flavors and there are artificial flavors. Two very different things. The natural flavors at least have to be derived from natural foods. Fruits, vegetables, meat, mushrooms, whatever. Now, can you consider them healthy? Not necessarily. Whenever people see the word natural, and that's what food manufacturers kind of rely on, they kind of think maybe to themselves, it's natural. It's got to be good for me, right? But that's not true. A natural flavor can be derived from a food using physical and chemical processes. Because what they're doing is they're breaking down that food, extracting out a particular component of it, the flavor, and then packaging that and selling it to food manufacturers.
So is it fair to say that one of the things that people can hide it under natural flavors is MSG?
No. No. MSG is a flavor enhancer. Mm. It's not considered a natural flavor. So that has to be revealed.
Gotcha.
And MSG, you mentioned something important that I talk about in the book, and that's acronyms. Mm-hmm. So in food labels, you often see acronyms that, you know, again, if you're not a chemist, I mean, even if you are a chemist, you may not even know what they represent.
What about hydrogenated soybean oil? What are your thoughts on that?
Okay. Well, hydrogenated soybean oil was created in order to make solid fats. Okay, something that could mimic, say, a butter.
Yeah.
And that's a whole bunch of chemistry there to take soybean oil. I mean, it takes a bunch of processing steps just to get the soybean oil. But if you want to harden it, it's called hardening, you have to react it with hydrogen gas and a catalyst, platinum or palladium. And that causes a chemical reaction in the oil to turn it into a fat.
Is that a trans fat?
Well, it can be. So there are two different kinds of hydrogenation. There's partial hydrogenation and there's complete hydrogenation. It's the partial hydrogenation that creates what are called trans fats.
Right.
And those are what the FDA decided in, I guess it was the 1990s, were bad for our health. You know, they were used to make margarine for years, decades. I mean, I grew up, you know, with partially hydrogenated fats. And here, much later, the government decides these aren't healthy for us anymore. They cause, you know, heart issues.
I think you wrote about with this, like, hydrogenated soybean oil, it has to go through this hexane process. Oh. That sounds kind of spooky to me.
Yeah, that's not the hydrogenation process. That's the actual isolating the oil from the soybeans.
Exactly. But doesn't that happen with, So can you explain that how hexane is what? Is it like a gasoline type product?
It's a gasoline related chemical. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's, and what does it do? It does it strip?
It's a solvent. Okay.
It's a solvent.
So, not just soybean oil, but, you know, any food oils and fats would be soluble in what's called a nonpolar solvent.
So if these products are being processed using a form of gasoline, is that gasoline then somehow, that hexane, in the food we're eating, or is it somehow removed in the processing?
It's actually removed because they want to reuse it. So it's recycled. So it's evaporated off of the soybean material where the oil was extracted from.
Really? It's completely somehow dehydrated.
I didn't say 100%. I'm sure there'll be traces of it. Yeah. But, you know, according to the FDA, you know, not considered to be toxic.
All right. I got a bunch that I want to ask you about. So let's keep this train moving. What about mono and diglycerides? I see them all over the place in food packages.
Yeah, those are emulsifying agents. And they help to keep the oily and watery parts of a food product from separating.
They have your thumbs up or thumbs down? What's
Thumbs up. They're fairly natural, you know, although to isolate them requires, you know, some technology.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned that when I mentioned natural flavors, you also said the flip side of that is artificial flavors. What are your thoughts on artificial flavors?
Even worse than natural flavors.
That gets the Weinstein thumbs down then.
Yeah, if I was king of the food industry, yeah, I would ban them.
Well, for today, I would like to crown you that.
Okay, and the reason I would ban them is that they're synthetic. Mm. They are chemicals that are intentionally synthesized and create a particular flavor that a food manufacturer wants, or if you mix these things together, you know, a combination that gives a certain flavor. You know, have you ever bought microwave popcorn?
Well, we make one of our own with no added oils and no added sugar. Yeah.
Okay. Well, say you buy one in the supermarket, a commercial brand, and you look at the package and it says butter flavored popcorn. Okay. Well, the butter flavoring, chances are it's not coming from butter. It's coming from an artificial flavor.
Got it. Yeah. How about, and this has been the bad boy for a long time, but I'd like to hear your thoughts on it, high fructose corn syrup.
That's a whole nother show right there.
Okay.
I was an analytical chemist and I did a lot of testing on high fructose corn syrup. So I'm quite familiar with it.
All right. You're not a fan, right? Or yes?
I was at the time, but no, after I left that company, I just decided I didn't want to eat anything with high fructose corn syrup. Now, I have broken that rule from time to time, you know, so I'm not perfect at it, but I do look at labels. If it says HFCS on there, I try to avoid it.
Right. What about gelatin?
Well, as a vegetarian, that was an automatic. So if you're a vegetarian or vegan, you don't want to be eating gelatin because it's based upon animal products.
Well, isn't it animal hooves?
It can come from hooves and other cartilage areas of an animal. Yeah.
How about xanthan gum? I see that in a lot of different products, a lot of hummuses, a lot of milk, stuff like that.
I would give it a hesitatingly plus thumbs up.
Why the hesitancy?
I think you can find xanthan gum naturally, but the vast amount of it is going to be made in labs and factories. Okay. And it's made using genetic engineering.
Yeah.
And it comes from, you know, changing the DNA of yeast so that they preferentially generate this xanthan gum and then separated and packaged, and it turns out to be a white powder, and that's what food manufacturers buy.
Mm. Okay. What about cellulose? See that a lot too.
Cellulose is a natural product. Obviously, all plants have cellulose in them.
Yeah.
And that's a structural feature of plants. And so, you know, I guess I'd give it a thumbs up. It's not as bad as other things you could eat.
Is methyl cellulose basically the same thing as cellulose? I mean,
that's a more processed formed. That's definitely a synthetic product. And, you know, it's a bulking agent or a gum. And it adds texture to food products. I mean, it's not awful, but, you know, if you're trying to stay away from additives, I would put that on the list.
Okay. How about pea protein isolates or concentrates? Because we see those in so many, you know, veggie burgers, veggie dogs, veggie nuggets these days. They're just ubiquitous.
Yeah. That's a little problematic. They kind of follow the history of texturized soy. You know, because all kinds of products were made by texturizing and processing of soy into soy proteins. Plant protein, hydrolyzed plant protein, there's not much information about that. I mean, I got curious about it as well. I wanted to find out, is it made similar to the soy products or is there some other processes used? And it's kind of secretive. You know, I searched the internet and I could not find any articles about how that's made. You know, it's made from yellow peas. If I did find that out. But in terms of the details, exactly how the protein is separated from the rest of the pea, I just found not very good details about how that's done.
Gotcha. So pretty sparse when it came to that. So, based upon that, would you give it a thumbs up or thumbs down?
I would eat it before I would eat the soy products.
So you do pea protein isolates and concentrates before you do the soy protein isolates and concentrates.
Okay. But it kind of depends. There's actually three different kinds of isolates you can get from soy. One is better than another. So you need to do a little bit of research.
So is that something that the food manufacturers have to put on the label? There's three different types?
No. Well, you will see the three different types. Okay, but you won't get information about the health benefits of them.
What are the three different
types? Some are more processed than others.
Do you know the three different types off the top of your head?
I knew you were going to ask me that.
No. If you don't, don't worry about it. Let's keep moving. I don't want to get stuck. Sucralose, that's 320 times sweeter than table sugar. What is that, and are you a fan of it?
No, that's another ingredient I try not to consume.
Okay.
It was actually invented by the company I work for, Tate & Lyle. It was discovered in London, England, back in, I think, the 60s or 70s. And it was an accident. It was, they were working with sugar, modifying it in different ways, chlorinating the molecules, which I won't go into, but trying to find new molecules to work with, you know, for food ingredients and other purposes. So they did this one experiment, and one of the chemists working on it was telling his other chemist of this is a new material that he came up with. And the coworker said, why don't you test it to see what it is, I guess. And the guy who was talking about this substance said, thought his coworker said, taste it.
Oh, no.
So he tasted it, and he had this like reaction. Wow, man, this is sweet. And that's launched sucralose.
Wow. Isn't that something?
Yeah. Serendipity.
And so is it not good for our health?
It was approved by the FDA. But it doesn't necessarily mean
it's approved by Mel.
Well, like I said, I don't eat foodstuffs with sucralose in them. Okay. I would put sucralose as the number one industrialized food ingredient in the world.
Wow.
In order to make it, it goes through multiple steps using very unsafe chemicals. And by the time you get to the end of the process, you get a white powder. Now, you know, chemistry processes are really good that they can be cleaned up, and all the bad stuff that was used to make this product can be essentially eliminated, or down to really low levels, like parts per billion, very low parts per million. And so, you know, you're never going to get rid of every single nasty thing in either a regular food or a synthetic food, but you get it down low enough where it's not considered a health hazard for humans. And that's the case for sucralose. I used to analyze this stuff. And so I know it's pretty, pretty pure, but knowing where it came from is the issue for me. Yeah.
What about sunflower lecithin? Because I see that in a lot of different food packages.
Yeah, there's different kinds of lecithin. So yeah, you can have soy lecithin as well. Lecithin is a natural product. We have lecithin in our body, even if we didn't eat junk food or fast food.
Is it fat? Is it a type of fat? What is it?
It's fat-like. It falls in the classification of lipids. Lipids are the general name given to nonpolar, you know, products that can dissolve in nonpolar solvents, like we were talking about soybean oil before.
Yeah.
And so fats and oils are considered lipids. Lecithin's in another class of lipids. Every cell in our body has lecithin in it. Our brain has quite a bit in it. So it's an essential biochemical for survival.
Gotcha. All right. I got a couple more for you. All right. You hanging in there? You doing all right?
Yeah, I'm doing fine.
Okay, good. You look great. So what about carrageenan? Because that is something that I think, you know, we used to have that actually in one of our engine 2 almond milks. And then we heard such an outcry from the public that we actually removed it. And so, I'll go on my little kind of tangent here. You know, we did our research, and it was determined that carrageenan was safe, and, you know, comes from a, you know, sea moss. But the one that was really problematic was the polygenin, which was a close cousin to carrageenan. And I think that, you know, some of these activist groups confuse the two. But I'd like to check in with you on that carrageenan.
Yeah, I've looked into that, and I think the verdict is still out. I mean, I just like you, I kind of read different reports on whether it's safe or not for human consumption. So it's not on my bad list, but I'm seeing it used less and less. Are you?
No, absolutely. It's just something that, like I said, the public has a certain perception about carrageenan, and it just doesn't make sense. If you can use something else, why not?
Yeah. It's a gum, and a gum is a thickener. So it makes food products more viscous. And as you say, there's all kinds of other choices out there for gums. I mean, you mentioned xanthan gum earlier. No, that's another one.
Enzymes are something that appear sometimes on labels. And it sounds to me, tell me if I'm close to the mark here, kind of like natural flavors. I'm not sure what it is, what it does, but it's just enzymes.
It's on the pet peeve list.
Oh, it's on the Mel pet peeve list.
Love it. Enzyme, that word is generic. I mean, every chemist knows what an enzyme is. But when you say the word enzyme, it's not referring to any specific chemical. Yeah. There are thousands, if not tens of thousands, of enzymes, you know, that are in our body that are used for making foods. So it's just too generic. It doesn't give you any information.
Got it.
Other than the fact, if you know, look up enzymes, you'll find that they are nature's catalysts. So they help speed up chemical reactions. So instead of a chemical reaction taking days or weeks to occur, an enzyme might speed it up in a few seconds or a few minutes. And so they're very valuable and very useful. But as far as food labels go, they're telling you hardly anything.
Good to know. What about citric acid? That's another one that we see a lot of.
Natural product. You do find citric acid in different foods in nature. But the citric acid that you'll find on food labels is not going to be natural. It's going to be industrialized. It's going to be made with a very complicated process. And you can almost consider it synthetic, not quite. But there are... There are yeasts that can be engineered to make citric acid. Yep. And so that part is sort of natural if you take the bioengineering out of it. But then to get the citric acid, there's a whole bunch of complicated steps that it has to go to become a nice white powder, you know, that people would buy. You could buy it at Amazon, or food manufacturers could buy it for their products.
This is great, Mel. Great. Vital wheat gluten that you refer to as the boogeyman for celiacs.
If you're a celiac, you want to stay as far away from vital wheat gluten as possible, because celiac disease is something to take very seriously.
Yeah.
And if you see that on a label and you have that disease, or maybe you have a protein allergy, a wheat protein allergy, you should think twice, about eating anything with that in it.
Right. So for those that have a gluten sensitivity or celiac, something like that.
Now for vegans and vegetarians who are into seitan, great choice if they don't have those health issues.
Got it. This is my last one for you. And then we're going to wind this down, Mel. But and I don't know if I'm pronouncing this right. Trehalose.
Oh, I wanted to talk about tree halos.
Tree halos, yes.
Tree halos, yeah. Let me check my notes on that.
Yeah, bring it.
It is found in the Taco Bell menu item, which is Taco Bell Grande Nacho Steak Taco Bell Grande Nacho Steak. Okay. Yeah. Isn't that, what's that?
No, I'm just saying, yes, yes.
Yeah. In that menu item, they use refried beans. And so this tree halos shows up in the refried beans. For what reason? I have no idea. It's because it's a really bizarre ingredient. I'd never seen it anywhere else in any other products that I've looked at, either in the store or in fast food restaurants. And so what it is, it's sourced from the cocoons of the Larinus masculate beetle. It comes from a beetle, and these are found in Turkey. And these beetles make cocoons, and it's from these cocoons that this material is extracted from. And it has some interesting properties. It can be found in plants. It can be found in animals, specifically insects, such insects as grasshoppers and locusts and butterflies. And it has an interesting property. It's a sweetener, okay?
Yeah.
And it's a substitute essentially for blood sugar. So instead of blood sugar being in the blood of certain insects, this tree halos is present. And it keeps the insect, or the plant for that matter, from losing moisture, from dehydrating. And there's an actual plant called the resurrection plant that it can lose a huge percentage of its moisture. I think, I don't know if it's 90%, I can't remember now, but a huge percentage of its moisture, and it will continue to live because of this tree halos chemical in its cells. So as far as food is concerned, this material is harvested from the cocoons. And unfortunately, when it's being harvested, a lot of the insects get harvested at the same time. So it's pretty much impossible to not get insect parts in with the tree halos that's used as a food additive. So if somebody's a really a strict, very strict vegetarian or vegan, and they don't want to eat anything with animals in it, then they'd want to avoid any products with tree halos.
Right. And that Taco Bell dish you just described.
Yeah. Well, true. Very true.
Although I wonder if that dish, you know, if you're going to go out in the desert for a while, maybe that dish could help you from dehydrating too prematurely.
Well, you're better off buying a large amount of refried beans, you know. You get a lot more of it that way.
Yeah. It's funny, Mel. I was just talking to a gentleman the other day who said he's like a 30-year vegan, and he doesn't eat figs because he's claimed that the fig has to be basically, it's made by a wasp, and every fig kills a wasp. So I don't know if you've heard that or not, but
no, never heard that one.
Yeah.
You don't come across figs in food products very often, though. That's probably why I've never looked into it.
Yeah. Well, the Fig Newton.
Fig Newton. Yes. You know, can you name others?
Not too many. Good point. Good point. Mel, I got to say that this has been an absolute blast, and I really, really appreciate your expertise and your book, Fast Food Ingredients Revealed. I'd like to actually close, Mel, by reading the last paragraph of your book, if you don't mind. Okay.
No, I'd like to hear it. I haven't read it in quite a while.
Okay, good. So you say, given the incidences of chronic diseases, the health system is in crisis. Given the incredible advances in medical and nutritional science, it's an absolute shame that people are still killing themselves with their forks. The powerful influence of junk food and fast food companies through the production of addictive industrial foods and the persistent and relentless marketing of their products, particularly to children, needs to be curtailed and regulated. There should be a ban on advertising of dangerous fad products similar to the controls imposed on the tobacco and alcohol industries. all commercial foods should have PFIs, which we talked about, PFIs on their labels alongside the nutritional data. More stringent laws could require food taxes on unhealthy foods to help pay for future health expenses. Without governmental intervention to improve public health, this trend is likely to continue until crisis levels of healthcare are reached. And then you close with this quote from the Food Labels Revealed podcast. Remember this: eat foods mainly from natural plants, not manufacturing plants. Well said, Mel.
Thanks.
So any last words that you'd like to say before we say goodbye today?
Yeah, I'll add a couple of things. The second half of my book is devoted to the research into foods that contain a lot of ultra-processed ingredients. And so I talk about some current research, and there's a lot going on. And I talk about what are called food scoring systems, which unfortunately the United States does not have yet. Apparently they're working on it, but it would help people who are buying foods in grocery stores pick out the ones that would be the healthiest for them. Not just nutrition, you know, it's talking about the processed element of the ingredients in those foods. And I guess lastly, if you're not looking at food labels, nutrition labels, I highly recommend you start doing it. Avoid foods that have these super long lists of ingredients. I say once you get over 20, beware. And then look to see, you know, what is maybe what you call, I don't like to use the word natural, but, you know, look for those food products that have a lot of synthetic or highly manipulated, highly processed ingredients, and try to avoid those.
Right on. Hey, Mel, hit me with a little plant strong fist bump, okay? You keep it plant strong, my friend.
Plant strong. Thanks a lot.
Yeah. See you next time. Fun.
I hope you'll support Mel and pick up a copy of Fast Food Ingredients Revealed. He also has a podcast called Food Labels Revealed with some of his research as well. And we'll be sure to link to both in the show notes. I don't know about you, but I sincerely appreciate Mel's candor and transparency when it comes to educating us on these chemicals and food additives that are in our foods. Remember, keep it fresh, keep it whole, and always keep it plant strong.
Thank you for listening to the Plant Strong podcast. You can support the show by taking a quick minute to follow us wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts. Leaving us a positive review and sharing the show with your network is another great way to help us reach as many people as possible with the exciting news about plants. Thank you in advance for your support. It means everything.
The Plant Strong podcast team includes Carrie Barrett, Lori Kordowich, Amy Mackey, Patrick Gavin, and Wade Clark. This season is dedicated to all of those courageous truth seekers who weren't afraid to look through the lens with clear vision and hold firm to a higher truth. Most notably, my parents, Dr. Caldwell B. Esselstyn Jr. and Ann Cryle Esselstyn. Thanks for listening.